Welcome. This is Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and I'm pleased to announce we have a great guest with us today, award-winning author and editor, Deborah Halverson. Deborah Halverson edited children's books for 10 years until she climbed over the desk and tried out the author's chair on the other side. Now she's the award-winning author of teen novels. Her debut book, Honk If You Hate Me, was published by Delacorte Press, an imprint of Random House Children's Books, in 2007, and it promptly won the Gail McCandless Literary Award. Deborah followed up that success by penning her second teen novel, Big Mouth, also with Delacorte, the very next year while caring for triplet infant sons. Today we'll be discussing her newest book, which was published last year. This one's nonfiction. Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies is the title, and it was published by Wiley Publishing in 2011. Deborah's currently working on three books in a forthcoming series for struggling readers and a forthcoming picture book about Santa Claus. Armed with a master's degree in American literature and a fascination with pop culture, she sculpts stories from extreme events and places, such as tattoo parlors, fast food joints, and most extreme of all, high schools. Deborah is the founder of a very popular writer's advice website, DearEditor.com, and she lives with her husband and her now 7-year-old triplet sons in San Diego, California. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we're very pleased to have you here, and I'm sure the first question most people are wondering is how you were able to write a novel with three babies in the house.
That is a common question I get, and you know, I think maybe it's easier to write a novel with three babies the same age in the house because they all nap at the same time. And as any busy mother will tell you, you learn to fit the work in the little cracks when they're napping, and that's what I did. I would walk them every day in the morning. We would walk a 4-mile loop, and then again in the afternoon, and that's when I would let my brain churn on the stories, and I'd send myself voicemails. And then when I would get back at home, I would drop them down in their cribs, 1, 2, 3, and then I'd drop myself down in a chair in a room between them, and I would retrieve those notes, and I would write. And it kept me on a very regular writing schedule through the day, so it was actually a very good thing. It's when they got older and started giving up those naps that the writing became more difficult. So it was actually a very productive time for me.
Well, I had read about you pushing the stroller, and essentially it seemed like writing your book as you pushed the stroller. And when I first read about that online, it just sounded impossible to me. But now that I hear that it was 4 miles, and then there was another 4 miles in the afternoon, right?
Yes, it was a sneaky way to get in the exercise at the same time. So it was a really productive and healthy period for me, if you ignore the fact that I didn't sleep because of the babies. But I think that a lot of writing takes place in your head away from your actual computer. And I often encourage the people that I work with when I do an edit for them, I give them the feedback on it. And at the very end, the last thing I tell them is go mull this for a while. Don't start anything yet. Just mull it. And that's what I would do on the walks. And that's where a lot of the writing takes place.
Do you feel that sometimes creative people, like writers, are trying too hard by not giving themselves that kind of dreamy ability to let their thoughts wander? Because a lot of people today are really busy, but they're also trying to write or paint or, you know, do some kind of creative endeavor. So do you think that mulling over time is crucial?
I think it's crucial, and I think we do it more than we realize. I do know that I've had a blog for many years, and a friend of mine who is also a triplet mom, she started her own blog. And after she'd done it for a few weeks, she came back to me and she said, "This is amazing." She said, "All day long, everything I'm seeing, I'm weaving into a story into my head and thinking how I can put it on the blog." She said, "Is that what your brain does?" And I said, "Is that not what your brain did all these years?" That's just how I think, and I suspect many writers are the same way. Just all through the day, they're spinning the stories in their heads, thinking about the angles to come at them. So even as they're driving along on the carpool or what have you, I think the mulling is happening. Even as it may appear that we're awfully busy, but a lot of the writing gets done in your head when you're driving to the grocery store.
But it seems like before that can happen, you have to have a particular project in mind. I mean, you have to have come up with a genre and a plot. And then is that your experience? 'Cause isn't it sort of focused daydreaming?
Daydreaming. Focused daydreaming is well put. I think a lot of that happens when you've got the actual nugget of your story and you're trying to work out how to make it happen, or you've put some things down already on the page and you're trying to work out how maybe it didn't come out like you intended it to. But there does need to be, while mulling is an important part, it's not the only part, and it's real easy to say, well, I'm working on it in my head. There is that sit-down time, and you really do need to have a project in the works to be working out in your head. It happens in many ways, and so that's one aspect. I think it's just one that gets a little short-shrifted in the credit area.
Mm. To me, it seems like if you don't sit down and write what you've been mulling over, then you'll continue to mull over the same thing rather than to move on to the next, you know, problem that you're facing and trying to figure out what it is you're writing about.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the other half of the equation really is the butt-in-chair method, which is a phrase that Jane Yolen, who is incredibly prolific young adult and children's writer, is known for, butt in chair. It's the actual work. You sit down and have to actually do it. And so part of being a writer is the actual discipline of doing the work. And so if you can set out a fair schedule, whatever that schedule is for you, where you're regularly sitting out, down and doing it, then that's where the mulling feeds in. Otherwise, you're just daydreaming about this book that you're never actually going to write.
You seem like you're capable of writing anywhere from what I've read about you in your blog. So do you like to work in...
I've been a multitasker my entire life. I don't like having a moment where something's not happening, usually two things. So that works in my favor. And with technology being what it is, you can really do any part of the writing process from just about anywhere. You can have your computer or whatever technology with you to actually do the writing, or you can be leaving notes to yourself on voicemail. It makes it a lot easier. Although I think then the challenge becomes collecting it all in one place and having that focus time. That's where I run into the most challenge, and I think a lot of writers run into the same thing, the focus time where you're pulling all those pieces together that you've done all over the place. And that's where the dedication comes to sitting down and doing.
With your latest book, Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies, you really had to pull a lot of pieces together, because I found this to be encyclopedic in its coverage. You just covered every single detail, I think, that, you know, would arise in the mind of someone who's setting out on a career of writing for young adults.
I really wanted it to be that. I really did want it to have anything I could pack in there in a fun way. One of the things... I enjoy reading books about writing, but sometimes they're just more inspirational than actionable, and that's fine. That's what they set out to be. This one, I really wanted people to be able to take action, take this information or these techniques, and to use it. And the way it came about really was, I was an editor for 10 years at Harcourt Children's Books, and then I am a writer now and a teacher and a lecturer. So I know all sides. I know the business side and the creative side. And I had wanted to put a book together that shows all those sides for people, for writers, and I was contacted by an agent about doing this. And I thought, this is what I've been looking for. And so it was real, a lot of things came together in that moment, and so I really wanted to pack all that in there. And I'm glad to hear that you find it that way.
Oh, I was very impressed, because you cover the broad picture, sort of, you know, everything a person needs to know about anything, like writer's block, but you actually get down to really tiny details, like the difference between a hyphen and a dash, which is, you know, that's something that's important. It's important to me, but I didn't know that it would interest so many people, you know.
I didn't mean to talk over you.
Oh, no, that's
okay. I had the true benefit of having worked with hundreds of writers before I was a writer. So I heard how a lot of people did their work in a lot of different ways. They exposed me to different techniques. Even as I edited them and guided them to trying to bring out the best in their piece and their writing, they were all telling me how they worked, and I heard so many different ways to do it and so many tips. And then I came in at the business side first. So in a sense, I have a sort of mercenary approach to it. The book is if you want to get published. It's not just if you want to write young adult fiction.
If
you want to publish it.
It's not just writing like a family story or something. It's actually writing for a particular audience with the idea of getting it to them.
Exactly. And I came in with the frame of mind, and what I encourage people to do is think about the positioning in the market first. because I came in the business side, and when an editor is reading your submission, they're evaluating the writing and the story, but they're also figuring out, how am I going to market this? How many can I sell? How am I going to best sell it? And so that really influenced how I put the book together. And in fact, it's why it starts out with finding your category that you're going to fit in, targeting your audience, because a lot of people will just write it and try and figure out who the audience is afterwards. And they'll try and figure out where does it fit in the marketplace afterwards. Well, then you have to go back and maybe change a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so this
if you do that from the beginning, you're more focused. And so I came in it with that, and that very much affects how the book was organized. This is for people who want to publish.
And people who just hear the title, Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies, may not realize that young adult also encompasses not just teens, but also what is commonly called middle grade. And would you explain what middle grade is?
It does. It's a kind of an umbrella term, young adult fiction or literature for young adults. Really means the whole thing, but it breaks down into more specific categories, with the 9 to 12-year-olds being those middle grade readers, those tween fiction readers. And they are more, their view of the world is less mature. They're trying to figure out really who they are, very much. Now, if we move up to the what we call YA, or teen fiction, or young adult fiction specifically, we're talking about more the 12 and ups. And then they're starting to open up a little more to a grander worldview, to kind of figure out, they're still figuring out what they are, but they're now trying to figure out how they fit into the greater world, and so there's a slightly higher sensibility there. So they break up the two categories into very specific groupings with different audiences that you target in a different way.
Okay, so when people hear Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies, it's not just young adults in the sense of
It's the whole thing. Really, the players are the same and the techniques are the same. It's just when you figure out who your audience is, you're going to tailor your themes to them and maybe a little bit your word structure. But the techniques are all the same about how to write dialogue that sounds young and how to have that youthful sensibility so you don't sound like a grown-up telling a story to a kid. Those are still the same regardless. And the players are still the same. You're sending it to the same agent and the same the same editors and publishers. They deal with the same block of the publishing industry. And generally speaking, as people who write for the older teens will often write for the younger ones, and they'll go back and forth and experiment. Sometimes they specialize, but really it's back and forth. So I wanted something that would cover everybody.
So did this book grow year by year? Like the whole 10 years you were editing, were you like making notes of thinking things that you would like to share with writers so that they would have an easier time realizing their dreams?
Later in my career, as a matter of fact, I was. I've been giving speeches. I mean, editors go around the country giving speeches about certain craft topics as well as the industry in general. So I kept all those. But every once in a while, I would write an editorial letter. I go, oh, that's a useful way to say that, and I stick it aside. So in the back of my mind, I have always been a writer to be anyway. So in the back of my mind, I felt that I would write a book about writing at some point. So I did stick those away. There was a certain awareness in there that I wanted to do this at some point.
So even your college education, I forget what your degree was in, but it was related to publishing, wasn't it?
You know, I was an English major and then an American Lit for my master's. And it's funny, all my life I secretly wanted to be a writer, but I couldn't get myself to admit that to anybody. And even when I was going into college, I convinced my dad that I wanted to be an English major because I was going to be a lawyer. And that was a good, thing to go into law school with an English degree. And it really wasn't even, I thought, and here's kind of the crux of it. I thought, even going into publishing, that a writer was this person who was born to write. They were born with this vault inside of ideas. Because if you gave me an assignment, I could write something great for you, but I didn't feel I had the ideas. And so I thought, well, maybe I couldn't actually do that. And it wasn't until I was working with all these amazing writers in the publishing industry that I started seeing that ideas are all around us. They're just putting them together. I would hear where they got their inspiration and realize, oh, that TV show I saw there, has been sitting, that episode has been sitting in my head next to that event I read about when I was 13, and now I realize that they can come together for a story. So I realized you have the ideas, it's just a matter of recognizing them, and once I did that, that's when I got the enough courage to see, okay, is this dream I have inside worth going for? And I sat down and I started writing, and I started writing Honk If You Hate Me, which was my debut book. I didn't even tell my husband what I was doing. I told him I was typing. And he would come home and he'd say, did you do a lot of typing today? And I said, I did a lot of typing.
Well, he must have suspected what you were up to.
He knew what I was doing, but he gave me this space to experiment. And it really wasn't until I contacted an agent with my finished manuscript, and then they sold it to a publisher that I announced to my colleagues at Harcourt that I was even writing. So that was kind of funny. I just needed the space to experiment for me. But it had been happening my whole life, and I had been listening to these experts for a long time and guiding them and learning it myself. So I had an incredible training ground. And so in the book, all of those people, all of those techniques came out in the book. And I called a lot of them up while I was writing it, and I put a lot of them. There are 16 incredible writers that have written most sidebars for the book. You know, in M.T. Anderson, the amazing M.T. Anderson wrote the foreword. I learned from the best, and that's a true privilege.
Well, there is a really strong community of writers when you're writing for young people. Is that your experience?
It is. That's how DearEditor.com came about, my writer's advice site. One of the beautiful things about the children's world is that sense of community. Everyone's always willing to give and help the other person, whether they're, you know, Newbery Award winners. Jane Yolen is writing, I don't know, she's on her several hundredth book, and she just launched a grant with SCBWI, the Society of Children's Books Writers and Illustrators, where they're giving a grant to mid-list authors. And she doesn't have to mess around with that. She could just write her books and sell it. But she's out there actively trying to help and encourage people. And that's the community that they have for children's books, especially. And that was one reason I decided to bring in those other writers, to not just take their techniques and put them in my words, but to give them a spot in the book. Because with children's books, the community is as much a part of the joy of writing as any other part of it. And you see that online with the websites and blogs that are devoted to children's literature.
Well, I absolutely agree with you about the strength of the community of writers for young people. You've mentioned Jane Yolen a couple times, and to me she seems like she might be kind of a role model for you, both because she's, you know, an amazing, prolific author, but she also spent her stint as an editor as well. And I'm wondering how you feel about the two different roles. Like, it sounds like at this stage of your life, you definitely prefer being the writer. And you recognize what that's given to you, but are there different skill sets, or is it very similar for writers and editors?
I think there's actually a lot of difference. There's overlap, certainly, but that's why a lot of the editors tell you, I don't want to write. It's a different thing. When you're an editor, it's almost a schizophrenic kind of activity. You're adopting different people's voices throughout the day. You have to figure out, if you're reading the manuscript, you can't advise them to do something that's going to make them sound different. It has to be within their way of writing and their style of writing. And so you have to be able to identify that and think along those lines. And your suggestions, if you suggest a change to a specific sentence, you know, it has to be in their voice. So I think they're experts at evaluating and spotting the voice and the technique and looking at the overall story. One of the fun things that I really enjoyed about editing was when you're positioning it for the marketplace, the editor is the one who writes the copy that goes on the back of the book or the front flap of the book, and that goes in the catalog, and that you'll see the descriptions you'll see on the website for the books, and we feed it to the salespeople. And so sometimes that requires you to completely adapt that voice. And I thought that was great fun, to try and pick up the writer's voice. And as I was, this probably ended up being good practice for me for developing my own voices. But so they have a skill set of really being able to evaluate and pinpoint what's not working and what is, and to articulate that. A lot of readers will read and go, I like that, or I don't like that. And that can be swell to hear, but it's not helpful. And so the editor has to be able to articulate why something's working or not. And so that's a different kind of reading. It's a real intense kind of reading. And I freelance at it all the time, maybe two, sometimes three novels a week. I'm incredibly busy with that. I love it. I really like that part of it. But when you're writing, you're really focused on one thing, one voice for a long time. And for me, that's probably, as a writer, that's the most challenging thing. I tend to have five different projects of my own going on because I jump. I think it's probably my nature at this point to jump from one voice to another.
Hmm. That's very interesting. So one of the editor's skills is honoring the voice.
It really is. And it's funny, you're right. I didn't realize how often I was bringing up Jane's name. She started out with a... When I started out at Harcourt, she had an imprint of books at Harcourt. So there was kind of that over... My career kind of started with that. But one of the things I do admire is she will have five different projects going on or more. And she'll, if you follow her on Facebook or her journal, she'll say, I revised this, and this, and there's three very different projects all that morning. And so I love the work ethic, and I love that she can jump around, and so I think I probably relate to that.
So you touched on something earlier about whether an author has, like, are people born with this innate talent you were talking about? You kind of always had this desire to write, and then were a little shy about sharing that was what you wanted to do at first. But do you feel that anyone can write? You know, anyone who has the desire to write can ultimately become a published writer, or are writers born, or can they be made?
I think there's a certain fallacy about the whole magic of writing, that it's something you're born with, and that's something I had to awaken to as I saw writers at work. When we get that finished book, we have the feeling that this was absolutely how it was meant to be, and it feels like it could only have come out this way, and it transports us to an entirely new place, and that's how it gets the whole magical feel to it, and you think, oh, I can't do that. But what it comes down to, if you sit down and you're with the writers who are doing it, or you're doing it yourself, you see that the writing is work. It's actual steps and techniques that you had to learn and practice over and over and over time. It comes to a point where the writer gets comfortable with these things, and it doesn't feel, they're not so aware they're applying techniques anymore. But you can really break it down and say, this person does that in this book, and he's doing that in that book. I like M.T. Anderson, I brought up earlier. What I like about his example is he's won awards for doing kind of fantastical historical fiction, and then he has real silly, wacky things, and then he can do kind of a stream of consciousness writing, as in his Prince Award-winning Feed. And each of those, you can look at it and you can see why it feels different. You can break it down and see, this is what he's doing. He's got more casual grammar in this one. And that's why it feels stream of consciousness. And you can break it down into techniques. And when you're first starting out, just like anything, it feels clunky. If you're first learning to dance, you're going to step on your own toes. And it's all very obvious what you're trying to do. But you get someone who's been doing it for a long time, and it looks graceful and like magic. And some of us have been working at it our whole life. A lot of writers have been readers their whole life. They've probably been storytellers, even in their casual conversation. And so they've been developing these skills for a long time. So it's like, that person was born to write. Well, they've been working on those skills for a long time. It just looks easy now because they're at this point with it. But that's what I tried to capture. And a friend of mine who has written about 16, 17 books, when I told her I was going to write the book, Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies, and that I wanted to put, you know, some techniques in there. So you can't break writing down like that. It's not a bunch of techniques. And then later in the conversation, she said, you know, I had this writing teacher once that told me, and I stopped her. I said, look, you learned the steps at one point. You're just so far removed from it, it's second nature for you. So I think that there's a magical feel at the end when everyone puts their own, combines those techniques like ingredients in a pot and gets their own special final brew. But it's something that can be learned. It's something you can train.
So I guess the thing that you're born with is both the desire to write and then the stick-to-itiveness to get through those awkward stages. And
yeah, there are probably some personality traits involved. You know, some people were born to be more focused with work ethic and things like that, and that plays into it too. So there are some personality traits that you'll probably find more commonly among writers too.
So I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and with me today I have Deborah Halverson, who's been both an award-winning author and also spent a number of years as a children's book editor. It was children's books, right, that you were editing? Or was it adult books?
It was anything from the little board books that your little kids chew on to, you know, through picture books into teen fiction. And I've done a lot of, outside of that role, adult fiction, but with Harcourt Children's Books, it was focused on the gamut of books for young people.
So you're clearly comfortable with a lot of different genres. Why did you start with teens? It seems like in some ways that would be the most difficult in terms of trying to capture the subject matter that they're interested in, you know, the slant that would appeal to them, respecting the way that they speak, you know, and communicate. And yet that was what you decided to go for first. Why is that?
When I started writing, I tend to be more verbose. When I write something, I write down a lot, and then I have to cut it down. It's almost easier to cut it down to a novel than to cut it down to a picture book for me. My first nature is there. My agent is going to start going out with a, I'm developing a series of young chapter books, and that turned out to be very comfortable. It's more concise. But I'm only just now starting to dabble into picture books for me. I think I like the longer form.
And yet, when you wrote your most recent book, your nonfiction book, Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies, you'd had to write very concisely because you covered so much material. So each subject only has a few pages. Was that a challenge?
That was so much fun to do. The bulk of the organizing work went into, and they did it right up front, which was we worked together, the editors and I. The editors were hysterically funny, so it was a great process. But we laid down the whole table of contents and everything, and I knew what I was going to talk about before I started. And so then I felt like I was just filling in blanks as I went through, and I was writing about a chapter a week on that. And it was an intense time with a lot of, you know, just actual FaceTime with my computer. But it flowed out naturally because I had done the pre-work. And I found that I really do like writing nonfiction. it was great fun to write.
Do you think you'll be doing a follow-up how-to for writers?
I've got some in mind. I do. I really want to write something on writing fiction. On writing funny fiction, because I think writing humor is one of those things. Maybe I'd like to tackle the big things and try and break them down. You know, it's so hard to break down what makes something funny. So I really want to write one on how to write funny.
Well, that would be a fun book to read.
Yeah. I would enjoy doing it. One thing that has always characterized my writing, even if it's just in an email, is I like to find a slightly different way to say something. That's what, when the agents initially contacted me about writing the Dummies book, I wrote back some silly little email to her, and she said, "That's it, that's why I want you, that's the voice." You know, I think it's fun to be playful and find a different way to say something, and that's in fact what I try and do with the writer's advice site, is kind of make it playful even as I deliver a straight fact. And it's a real challenge to cut it down, like I did for this book or the website, to cut something down, some big abstract thing, to cut it down into two sentences or three sentences on this is how it is. Great, I love it.
I thought you did a great job, and I like the way different sections are independent of each other. You can just go into the book at any point and read a chapter and get a lot out of that chapter. It's not like you have to have read them in order.
Right.
I
found with this book is this is a massive series. I think the Dummy series has about 1,200 titles, and they're in their 20th year. And so I had always wondered how they did it, so I really loved getting a peek into how it works. And they have their ways of organizing, but then they just said, okay, now write what you want. And so I got to put together, these are the things I wanted in the book, and this is how I want to say it. And they just nodded a lot and helped me, like good editors, you know, helped me be clear.
Did you have any reservations at all about writing a book that had four dummies in the title?
My boys liked it because they got to say, Mommy's a dummy. No, they were five when I got the book. So no, I just, it strikes my, that's how I come at things. I like to look at the playful side of things or the ironic side. The dummies readers are not dummies at all, and that's where the fun of that series is. They're actually very intelligent people who want to know what they want to know when they want to know it, and it really organizes books in that fashion, and that really appealed to me.
And how did the editors find you? Like, how did they, because you said they approached you, right?
Right.
So how did they know that you were interested in, or might be interested in doing this? Do you think seeing you talk somewhere, or like at some social event for editors?
Very much networking. Networking over the course of a lot of years had my name mentioned to the right person at the right time. They were looking for someone, and they said, do you know someone who would be great for this? Oh, it's Deborah. Go talk to her. One of the things that I love about this time we're in right now with the Internet, that authors are so empowered and can create their own networks. And just through, whether it's Facebook or whatever, you meet so many people, and they see what you're doing. Just if you're just your regular post, oh, I'm speaking here or here, and they know you're a speaker on these topics, and so they come to you when that's coming up. And that's really what happened just over the years of knowing agents and editors and authors. The right person was in the right conversation at the right time, you know? Networking is absolutely imperative right now for authors in terms of selling your books and getting the word out, creating a buzz about your books that are coming out. And there's so much is possible now with the Internet. It's a true blessing for authors.
Well, technology is changing everything. And how do you feel that it's changing the way authors work? Or
when I started as an editor at Harcourt in 1995. And at that point, if you were a new or mid-list author, you still had to do your own publicity. But you didn't have a lot of ways to do it. You maybe had an immediate writers group, or you could buy a mailing list and send out postcards to a bunch of people, whether they be bookstores or librarians or teachers. And that was kind of about it. And you would have to hope for maybe word of mouth. Now, even when my book, Honk If You Hate Me, came out in 2005, 2006, there's still we didn't know how to harness the Internet yet, so there wasn't, I didn't feel like empowered, like I could spread the word about it so much. So now, 5 years later, when the young adult fiction for dummies comes out, I've already got, I know hundreds of people online, and I have the opportunity. One will pop up and say, "Hey, we have a writers group meeting. Do you want to Skype in, you know, and talk to us about it?" And so there's so many more ways for authors to reach out now. You can have your blog, you can have regular podcasts, you can have a radio show like your own that gets put up on the Internet and anyone can access it at any time. And that wasn't possible a few years ago. So there is so much empowerment just because of that going on. So technology is really helping us. I mean, I know it's creating a lot of havoc in what is the industry. You know, who are the players, the publishers versus self-publishers versus author services. But there's also, as much as it can be cause some scariness, it's really empowering writers, and I'm all for that.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about self-publishing. How do you feel that's changing?
That changes, day by day. That was the trickiest part of the book to write, because how can I not be too specific about it, because so much changes. Self-publishing is a great tool for writers who have a very targetable, identifiable niche market. How-to or nonfiction writers, it's great for them because they can find their groups online very easily. And so it's a very useful way for them to be in control of the process, and they can really run their own ship there. Now, where it becomes more challenging for fiction writers, especially for children's writers, because our audience is kids and you can't access them on the Internet. There are laws that prevent you from doing that. So it becomes harder to tell the world about your book when it's just a general story about, say, a teenager trying to find themselves in high school. I mean, where's your identifiable market? It's any teen, and you can't reach any teen. It's not that easy. So if you self-publish, it's up to you completely to market that. And that's a challenging thing to do when we're talking general fiction. So that's still shaking itself up, and people are now understanding there are these tools, there are these companies I can go to who will help me publish it. But how do I make the world, how do I make my audience aware of it? So I guess that's a problem that can happen whether you've got a traditional publisher behind you or not. But it's a great, self-publishing is especially good for those who have a niche market that they can target. It's a little more challenging for those of us who write for the general teen reader.
So your book that you wrote for Dummies, The Writing Young Adult Fiction, could have been a self-published book, although you wouldn't have had the background of the way that the editors at this company know how to structure these books.
Right. If you look at it that way, I know who my market is. Here's what's self-publishing. It kind of is two things. The creation of the physical book. We're going to ignore the writing, of course. The creation of the physical book and then the promoting of it. If you have, you know, Random House as your publisher, you're still going to be doing the marketing of it. So that discussion can go for either group. But self-publishers have to be willing to learn a whole new skill set. They're going to have to learn about layout, cover design. They're going to have to do a lot of research on the different companies to find out who's going to give them a better deal, who's going to give me the electronic platforms. You know, these people only, I can only upload to Amazon if I go with these people, or I can only put my digital book on, you know, Nook if I go with these people. So there's a huge amount of time and work that goes into that, and then you have to pay for it all. And you have to decide how many of these books can I sell. So there's that whole business side. And if the writer wants to be a business person, they can take on that challenge. And there are people who have shown that it works. I'm not going to look at the specific stars who have sold millions, but there are people who sell, you know, maybe thousands of copies of their books. The average, I think, is about 100 copies.
Well, all this makes it seem...
They're willing to be businessmen. And a lot of writers don't want to do that. They don't want that part. I didn't want that part when I started out. I had seen it. I didn't want it.
And so far, you're not exploring those sorts of avenues for yourself.
I'm thinking maybe that humor book. I don't know. I don't know. I won't rule it out at this point for my nonfiction, but for my regular fiction, for me still, a traditional house and the support they can give you on giving a polished product and the credibility of it, I still favor that for my fiction.
So however people go about publishing, whether they explore self-publishing or traditional publishers, it seems like the book is alive and well, right? Is that what your thoughts are?
Physical book?
Oh, maybe not physical, but there's still going to be a role for authors to play.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's only more. We talked about technology, and people are reading. A lot of times they're going online with their technology, but they're just doing a lot of reading these days. The love of reading is alive and well. And so I think as long as people are reading anything, they'll be reading books, whether it's in the electronic form or not. So there's always going to be opportunities for writers. It's just a matter of, you got to kind of, we're at a really bumpy time right now. And it's scary as the industry is trying to fight it out. So I tell people, that's fine, just focus on writing your books right now. The big people in the boardrooms will duke it out over who's going to be, you know, selling the books, what are going to be the major outlets and formats. But keep writing so that you regardless of what they work out.
Yeah, how that shakes out in the end. So it seems like one of the hardest things to do with writing for young people is achieving the right voice. Did you have much difficulty with that in your own work?
For me, I found it a very natural place to go for me, to write in a young person's voice. I have always been, I think perhaps my background with being fascinated by pop culture, I'm always listening to how people talk of any age, but I really have focused on teens and listened to how they talk and how they break it down, and it was very comfortable for me to write the more loose, casual sentences of young people, and to so I could sound, so that my voice could sound like them. They wouldn't say, I mean, they may say stop running, but they're just as likely to say, you know, quit with all the running. You know, you get a little more playful, youthful flavor that way. So I've always been listening and hearing that structure, and I like to have a little fun with grammar. And it's very hard to spell check my manuscripts, takes so long because the computer doesn't like how I put sentences together very often. It's always telling me, you know, grammar check, change this.
So when you say you spend a lot of time listening, where are you listening to teens? Is it like physically going to the mall and listening, or are you like noticing what they sound like when they're blogging?
You know, I don't sit down and listen to teens in particular. Just in general, taking in how every group talks. I've a lot of writers there. They love being wallflowers and listening to people, and I've always done that. I am happy to go somewhere by myself and just sit and take in everybody around me.
That must be a little bit of a luxury for you now with triplets. To go by someplace
yeah,
by yourself.
I go places myself a lot. Although they all went to school at the same time, you see, there's the benefit of triplets.
That's true.
All of a sudden, one day, boom, the house was empty. So I could have a regular writing schedule. And what I'll often do is go up to there's a Starbucks by my house, and I'll put on my earphones, but I won't actually turn anything on, so I'll look like I'm writing in the. And I think I'll feel somewhat productive when really I'm not typing anything. I'm just listening to everybody. And it's a popular hangout for the high school next door, so that helps. But I think writers are by nature listeners, and they're observers. And that's why they are so adept at trying at capturing voices, different voices. You know, it's just a matter of figuring out the skill. You know the voice you want to create, but how can I do that with words? And so if someone says, well, you just get a little loosey-goosey with your grammar and it sounds younger, you're like, oh, that's how you do it. And then you start paying attention, you say, yes, that is how they talk. So things like that.
So what exactly is your fascination with pop culture? What is that? Have you always been interested in that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, I watched everything, movies, TV when I was growing up. I worked at the warehouse record store, you know, and watched every movie that came out. My friend worked in a movie theater, and so when I wasn't there, I would go off to the movie theater. And then I was reading voraciously at the same time, and just like I've always been doing too many things at once. And I just, you know, I need my people.com fix every day and all that. Part of it, I think, comes about with, I've always been interested in advertising. That may not sound related at first, but I love the idea that you can manipulate someone's way of thinking by what color you choose for something or where you put something on a shelf. You know, it's just how you position it. If you put a different label on something that's the same product, it'll sell to different people. I've always been fascinated by that. And part of that is observing how people behave out in public, what they're buying, what they put on. And that's being tapped into what's popular of each time. And I love that, and I think that's probably why I like the business side of publishing, because you really need to understand about positioning stories for a specific market. And I am absolutely fascinated in with how that works. You do that with your stories. When you're writing a story, you're spinning a story. You're spinning it to engage your readers and make them have go through a certain thought process. And so it's actually a very manipulative act. It's very much giving, you know, voice to these characters you've created, but you're kind of manipulating your readers, and I like that. I like the power of that.
I want to, again, remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. We're broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. I'm Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, your host for the hour, and with me I have a very accomplished writer and editor, Deborah Halverson. Her latest book is Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies. It's an encyclopedic tome, but it's actually very readable, very easy to gather all you need to know to get started if you want to write for children. So what ages, like 9 to 18?
Yeah, that would be the range.
Yeah. So we've covered some different topics. I'm curious about what has been the aftermath once you became a published author as opposed to an editor. So you worked for 10 years at least 10 years as an editor, 10 years at Harcourt anyway. And is it a lot different interacting with fans as an author? Do you hear from your teen readers?
I spend a lot more time talking with writers than the actual readers, other writers, I guess, who are readers of my stuff. That's something I missed so desperately when my triplets were young and I stopped working at Harcourt. I had to stay home with with three babies. And I missed the daily talk about books. I craved it, and it was a few years before I figured out how to do it, and that's when I thought, oh, I can create that community feel and get people talking with my writer's advice website. And so that's where I spend most of my time talking is other writers about the active writing.
Well, that makes sense. You would gravitate towards that because that was your career, was interacting with writers. So do you have some program coming up that's special for writers on your website?
I do. One thing I want to do, I want to make it a yearly event, but I have something called Revision Week coming up March 5th through 9th on DearEditor.com. And what I'm doing for Revision Week is what we've been talking about. I'm turning to the community of writers. I'm bringing in six prolific, very well-respected writers to talk about their revision process. You know, how do they, some of them, there's certain, how do they go, how many drafts do they do? What draft do they show their agent? Or do they use critique groups at this point in their career? What are some of the more radical things they've had to do to a book? You think these people who have Prince Award, Prince Medals, and Newbery Awards, that they must do it right the first time, or maybe they have an upy draft and they do the second one and then they've got it. And you find out they've worked through some for a long time and then they shoved it in a drawer and didn't come back to it for years, that sort of thing. And so I'm bringing them in for Revision Week and I'm asking them questions. I'm going to have Henry Winkler and Lynn Oliver have 17 books in a chapter book series. They're going to talk about that, working with chapter books. Lynn Oliver is also collaborating now with Theo Baker on some chapter books. He's going to be there too. Cynthia Leydig Smith is a best-selling paranormal young adult fiction author. She's going to talk about teen fiction. Kathleen Kroll is going to talk about revising picture books and books for younger readers, the younger chapter books and nonfiction. And then Nathan Bransford, he used to be an agent in children's books, and he's now a writer of them, and he's going to talk about the process of revising when an agent is involved. You know, how much goes on before you even send it to an editor. And then I have an adult, someone to talk about adult fiction, and he hasn't given his final yes, so I won't say his name yet. But it's really about, let's hear from the people who do it, how they revise.
And this is like a free event that anybody can come to?
Each day that week you log in and there's a different person there talking about it. And in fact, to make it kind of fun, I'm giving away a free edit on each day where I will, whoever wins that random drawing, I will critique the first few chapters of whatever piece they're working on for free. And then at the end of the week, I'm going to have a grand prize where I'll do their entire novel, the winner. I'll edit the entire novel.
So anyone who's listening that's interested in writing and getting a critique from a woman who is not only an award-winning author but also has edited books for children for 10 years, that might be a really good website to visit. It's DearEditor.com.
Yeah, you've made your resolution at the year to write it. Now we're getting to the point where we need to start revising what we've been writing. So that's where I decided to time it for March, the beginning of March, the first week of March.
And did you have to do much revising for your latest book, which is the nonfiction book, Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies?
That happened really on the fly. It was the fastest book I've ever been involved in. They worked quickly there. That was 5 months from starting to handing it off to the printer. And so the revising had to happen kind of as we went along. And they would, I have never seen turnaround like that. I would send them a chapter and they would give me feedback 2 days later. It was more fine-tuning than anything. And then they would ask questions about, because they focus on nonfiction for adults. So they would be able to come in and say, what do you mean by this? You know, where it's something that made total sense to me being in the YA industry for so long. So there was revision involved there just in making everything clear. I mean, but the whole, like I said, we really were careful about structuring it to begin with. So that was a very fun experience. And it's different for me. A lot of people, when they write fiction, they say, should we outline the whole thing first or should we just write it on the fly? My books I've written on the fly, you know, just as the next chapter comes. I know the benchmarks I'm going for, but I haven't outlined it. It was a different process.
So there are many aspects that we could talk about of writing for young adult. readers. But, you know, this book covers so much material, we have to kind of limit ourselves to pick and choose. But it is a great book for anybody who's actually interested in writing for young people to pick up. But I'm kind of interested in setting. Could you describe a little about how people can create a real world for their fictional characters to enter?
Setting is one of my particular, it's one of the flags I run around with. I think these days it gets a little bit neglected. But the thing is, it's one thing to look at the photo of a forest, and it's another thing to be entirely in that forest with the crinkle of the damp leaves under your feet or the gentle breeze fluffing your hair or, you know, the gnats flying around your face, that sort of thing, until you actually you smack at them. That feeling of being there, there's looking at it and then there's living it. And I think that too often when we're so focused on plot and character, characterization these days, and action, plot, action, and characterization, that's where our main focus is, and understandably so, I think that setting gets neglected, and with setting you can have a much richer novel. And the thing that people forget is that setting can actually help you characterize your characters to bring them to life. It can help push the plot forward. It can help give it an overall richer experience. And so I try to encourage people to incorporate setting into their stories, and all aspects of it will improve as a result. So I try and really get them to focus on the reader's five senses and making sure in each chapter that they have 2 to 3 textual references or sensual references, where it's a smell or a feel that gives it that brings the reader in a way other than their eyes, other than looking. And so that's real important to me. I don't want people to stop and then give long descriptions of setting, because, you know, then we're thrown back to the Henry James American classic where you get the long paragraphs of description, and that's really not the style today, and it's not what young readers want. It's more of a sprinkling. You want to sprinkle it in as opposed to splash it. And so you sprinkle it in between lines of dialogues, and you give it a job. You make the setting, well, here we go. If we're looking at teen fiction, there's a very common thing of putting, when a teen is upset, they run to their room. That's the place they go to for escape. It becomes almost a cliche, and every teen knows their room, and it's just, there's not much you can do with it. But let's say you've got a teen who's upset, and they go to their room, and it's locked for some reason. They can't get in. Where are they going to go? Put them somewhere that's going to push them out of their comfort zone. Put them in a setting, say, send them out to the garage. Mom's going to make them go dig out the garage, and then they find their baby photos, and they go through that. And they're forced to deal with their problems in a different way. It pushes your character to a new place, and it can help push your plot to a new place. And so I really focus on setting in the book. That's really an important element. Using the props, the way a character grabs a pen, or whether they're lounging or sitting up straight in that stiff chair or that soft chair, makes a world of difference in how the mood of that character comes across.
Interesting. I was wondering, as you have spent a lot of time writing your two novels for teens, do you feel that writing for teens makes a person more able to converse with teens? I'm just curious if, you know, you kind of enter their world more, maybe develop more empathy and more of an understanding of how they communicate.
It probably does, because you're having to be more aware of their younger sensibility. Adults tend to really critique what they do and why they say it, or, you know, at our better moments we do. Whereas teens are less likely to do that. They'll judge, act, and react. And if you're thinking in that way when you encounter problems in the writing, you know, problems that you put in their conflicts, it probably makes you empathize more with how teens are encountering the problems that you're dealing with if you're talking to them in your house or at school or what have you. So it probably helps in the actual conversation. I think if we're more aware of their particular brand of hyperbole, we tend to roll our eyes when they say, oh, this is the worst thing in the world. You know, we think it's just teen drama. But if you're writing in that manner, you know, you're embracing that, you're seeing for them, maybe it is. In their context, it's a really bad thing. What to you might seem a tiny hurt to them is extremely powerful. It can probably make you better able to relate with them on one-on-one if you're face-to-face.
And I'm also curious, does watching your sons make you want to write books about what they're doing and, like, how would...
Oh, it does.
Do you have any, like, reservations about invading their privacy or how you're going to handle that as they get older?
They've shown up in each of my books so far, just as little background cameo characters. But I think more than anything, the books I pick to read with them, every time I read a book, I want to write that kind of book. And so I spend a lot of time reading picture books with them. I want to write picture books. And now that we're reading chapter books, of course, I write a beginning chapter book series. So they influence what I want to write about. Their actual experiences, I blog about them sometimes. I did more when we were little, when they were little. But I try and just pull out unique moments but not spend too much time on their specific... I don't even mention their names or that sort of thing when I'm online. But they help inspire me because of the choices of books they make. And I find myself wanting to write those kind of books for them. So I think that happens with a lot of writers. I noticed that over the years when they would have kids, they would start writing different things.
Do you have any advice for listeners on how to inculcate love of reading and writing in their own children?
I'm just a sort of radical approach. My boys are 7 years old, and we haven't had TV ever in their lives. We unplugged it when the boys were 5 months old. We canceled our cable because we weren't watching it. We thought, why are we paying for this? And we've never turned it on again, and our TV doesn't have an antenna, so it doesn't work. So all we do, we read. Occasionally, I'll, you know, rent a video for them. But they have read since they were, when they were 3 and a half, I started with Charlotte's Web. And I've always tried to find, you know, more wholesome things that they can digest at a younger age, but I've always come at them with full novels. I mean, we do have our picture books. I try and find a balance, and our chapter books as they got into that, but they've just read through the series, Kenneth Oppel's wonderful series, Airborne series, which each book is 500 pages. We read through it together, and they just sit there for hours and just listen. And then I got the audio books, and they've listened to them, each of the books in the series. These are 10-hour tapes, or excuse me, 10 CDs, so I don't know how many hours. And they have listened to those each probably 6 or 7 times.
Wow.
It's just a matter of, this is what they do. When they're bored, they'll grab one. If they are done with their toys, they'll sit and read a book. And it was a very deliberate choice on my husband's part to do that. And one of the amazing things that I've seen from that, just for them to sit down when they're bored and grab a book is huge. You know, I walk up the stairs and I have to pick them up so I don't trip on them. But they have, since they were about 4, and now... So they're triplets, so they're in the same developmental space. They have had a story running. They started when they were 4. We were living in England, and it's called The Bus Driver Story. It was about the people they would meet. And they have kept it up for the past 3 years. And they tell it on the way to school, on the way home. They walk around the table in like a little caravan, around and around, just telling the story, adding characters from each new book that we get. So they're storytelling. So one day maybe they will be writing, but they're already storytelling. They understand main characters. And I've talked to them about story arc. So it's just, that's how I've done it.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see what they end up doing as they get older.
It'll be fascinating to see how this plays out. But they're very articulate in how they form their thoughts, and that was a big decision.
Yeah, that was a radical.
Full novels.
Radical decision. Well, I'm sorry, but we've come to the end of our time. I think we could spend another couple hours talking about your career and writing for young people. But again, this is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. Our guest today has been Deborah Halverson with her latest book, Writing Young Adult Fiction for Dummies. Thank you for being with us, Deborah.
Thanks, Cheryl. It's been fun.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com, and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.